Now, Dave has no doubt with good purpose, but unfortunately also planted himself right in front of a lot of you. Why don't those who can't see me, there are three seats here, several seats over there, why don't you move now? At least I'll get to see you. There's a downside to it, I admit, but nevertheless, I'll see you. Pat Kirby, why don't you come over here? Huh? Pat, give me your hand. This is Pat Kirby, who is an old friend of mine through email. She read a book of mine called Education for Life and wrote a letter saying that many nice things about the book. Anyway, this is our first chance to meet, and I'm very pleased to meet you.
At least not virtually.
Right, at least not virtually. Come on, Tracy. There's this place here and there, or can you see me? Oh, okay. Well, when we talk of the eternal now, we're talking in a very different term from the way most of us think. There was a story of a group of four Italian ladies who were talking about their sons, boasting as usual. I don't say usual for Italians, usual for mothers. And one woman said, well, my son is a priest and everybody addresses him as father. And the next woman said, well, mine is a bishop and everyone calls him your grace. Well, the third said, mine is the pope and everyone calls him your holiness. Well, the fourth was out of it altogether and she was thinking, what can I say? Well, my son is very big, 6'4", 6'6", huge, very heavy. Everybody, when he looks at him, he says, oh my God. And so our tendency is to think big, biggest, and so on. But in reality, everything is right here. Everything is right now. And we must understand life in a very different way if we are to gain not just abstract philosophical lessons from it, which is always interesting, but nonetheless not always useful when you've got to make sure you don't cook the souffle too so long that it falls, and don't harden your scrambled eggs too much, and so on. You want to think right here, right now. Nonetheless, the truth is that that eternal now is also here. And the more we can draw on that eternal presence, the more we find that everything we do can be done well. You'll find that the more that you can attune yourself to the divine inspiration, the more, wherever you are, you don't think in terms of, oh, when will I find God? Or someday, I've met many people in India who say, well, someday I'll retire, then I'll spend my time meditating. What a waste of a life. I met somebody in Vancouver who was a very rich man, and he said, well, my life begins when I come home from my work. I can close the door on my meditation room and I can pray to God. And I thought, why waste all those hours till you get home? Can't you pray to God where you are? Isn't God always with you? Can't you be in a state of devotion even while working and making all those millions? What do they mean otherwise? Whether you have millions, whether you have nothing, doesn't really mean anything. It's all God's anyway. You're just taking from God here and putting him here. It doesn't make any difference. But the fact is that if you can think of God all the time, that is a kind of meditation. Yes, we need to meditate too, because otherwise it's only affirmation and you pretty soon forget him altogether. So we need time for God in silence, in prayer, but we should take that outwardly. And God gives us this illusion that all is linear. Everything goes from here to here to here. Somebody told me a very interesting story. There was a book I discovered in India. It's called The Book of Bhrigu. It's not a book the way you and I think of books, that you go to the library and you see a bound volume. It's really a manuscript containing, it takes rooms to house it. but it contains prophecies about the lives of many people in the future. And I went to this thing, and it was fascinating because it told me things about myself I didn't even know. It said, for example, he has two brothers, but a living sister isn't possible for him. It's not in his karma, although one will die in his mother's womb. Well, I'd never heard of my mother having a miscarriage, so when I went home, I asked her, and she said, yes, she'd had one. Fascinating. It said that in 2 months, within 2 months, he will leave for his country, America. And in fact, it turned out that I had to go back to America within 2 months. It said that after he gets back, he will be welcomed and given a high position. Well, there was no position in the organization that I was in that I could have that was higher than what I had. But when I got to Japan, the vice president died, and so they made me the vice president. And I always say, Riley, not always, sometimes, Riley, I was the token male on that board of directors. The rest were all women. Anyway, they needed the token male, and I was it. And how could he know? This was something supposed to have been written not just a few years ago, thousands of years ago. Well, here's the fascinating story. Somebody told me that he went to India. He was an Indian, but living in Los Angeles, and went back for a vacation. He went to this Bhrigu Sanghita, and in the reading it said, while this is being read, there will be a thunderclap. And he said the sky was completely blue, not a cloud. But just as that was read, there was a loud thunderclap. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that Bhrigu, back in time, linearly, from us, thousands of years ago, made it happen now? I don't know. I don't know the answer. But I do know that all saints have declared that God is here and now, that there's really no time in God. Everything goes in a circle. It's like a pendulum which swings forward and backward. Everything in the universe is dual. God was one. And when he created the universe, he had to do it by producing the illusion of duality. One of the exciting, you know, when I write books, yes, I do it to help other people, I hope, but the person I'm really helping is me. And it's so exciting for me to come upon some way of understanding something that I'd never thought of before. To me, it's really an adventure. And I thought, how can vibration, which scientists also say everything is in a state of vibration, but how can vibration produce the illusion of everything we see? I mean, this chair that you're sitting on, which I hope doesn't get too hard, but nonetheless it feels hard compared to your body can't sink through it. Why? It's really more, it's only vibration of energy. That's what science says. Yogis long ago said that. And they said that energy is a vibration of thoughts, and that thoughts are a vibration of still consciousness, the unmoving consciousness of God. And that God brought everything into manifestation out of his own mind. And I was thinking, now how is it possible, though, that vibration should make things seem so solid, so real? Your body doesn't sink into the chair simply because it's a different vibration. But both are only vibrations. You know, there's more space in your body than there is substance. There's as much space, relatively speaking, as there is between the stars in outer space. It seems inconceivable, but if you could remove all the space in your body from it, you would sink to a little dot so small it might not even be visible. It would have the same weight, but it would be so small because there's so little substance there. And then even that substance is insubstantial because it too is energy in a rate of vibration that seems solid. And I was thinking, now, how is it possible that, how can I get this point across to people? Well, it isn't a literal thing, but it gives you some idea that if you have the tines of a tuning fork, for example, moving fast enough, they look solid, don't they? You have a propeller, and it's going fast enough, it looked quite like a solid disk. That's not a very scientific explanation, but it'll do, because it gives you the understanding how movement, or even an illusion of movement, can give an illusion of reality of substance. Nothing really is substantial. That's how Jesus was able to create wine out of water, how he was able to walk on water. He just changed the vibrations. It's all mind anyway. There was a Sadhu Haridas. He was an Indian sadhu in India. He happened to be in a boat with, my tongue is getting parched here. And so he was in this boat with a Christian missionary. And the missionary was trying to convert him. And Sadhu Haridas said, well, what could your Jesus do that I can't do? Because he performed many miracles publicly and so on. And the missionary, they were in a boat. It was a natural thing for him to think of. He said, well, he could walk on water. And this Sadhu Haridas said, is that all? He got out of the boat, walked on the water, and the boat followed him wherever he went. Miracles are nothing. Jesus said it too. He said, greater things than this shall ye do. But he said, unless ye see signs and wonders, ye shall not believe. And so he performed miracles. But that's not the real miracle of Christ's life. The real miracle of Christ's life was that he changed people's lives. He changed their consciousness. He made them love God. He inspired them with that love. This is what it is really about. But the illusion of movement gives the illusion of matter. If you think of a planet in space and a sun that gradually moves across the horizon, there would be no way of knowing if that movement took place in 1 second, 1 hour, we'd call it a day anyway, but 24 hours, 12 hours, a billion years, there'd be no point of reference for you to be able to say that it took any time at all. You'd measure time, if you tried to, only by that one movement. It wouldn't really exist for you. But then you take into account other things happening. Waves of grass moving, moths and bees and flies, your own breathing, your own heartbeat, and the composite of all these different movements, some of them slow, some of them fast, how time varies for each one of us mentally. Anyway, if you're really expecting something, 5 minutes can seem like 5 hours. Or, contrarywise, 5 hours can seem like 5 minutes if you're really involved in something. I remember I was writing a play once in college, and I was so absorbed in it that I hardly knew that time had passed. And I started in the morning, and I looked up, and it was evening. I couldn't believe my eyes. And not only that, I felt such an exultant joy, because you know when you really concentrate, this great inner happiness comes. And I remember the snow began falling that evening. I went out and ran in the snow singing. And in those days, I used to sing in the streets and paid no attention to anybody. And it was 9 hours passed, and yet it seemed like 9 minutes or less. No time passed. Time is an illusion. There's really no yesterday, today, and tomorrow. That's how many saints have made this statement in all religions. It's not just one particular saint makes this declaration. It's just the experience of every soul. It goes beyond time and space into the timeless now. But that now is not then. People think, when will I have God, like the reading that Christy just read to us? When will I do this? When will that happen? I was saying this yesterday, and it's something to think about, really. It first dawned on me really strongly when I was reading and editing Yogananda's The Quatrains of Omar Khayyam. He wrote an explanation for them, and I edited them, because he didn't want to bother with the fine points of editing. And as a writer who edits his own work, I can tell you that really editing is, you can compare it to plumbing. It's just putting the pipes together in such a way that the words flow right. the thoughts flow right. But the real inspiration was there already. It was just a matter, and this is why he didn't want to bother with that kind of thinking. It's a lower level of thinking necessary to get your points across to the public, but for a master, just not worth it. So when you think, why did he need editing? Why couldn't he just do it all himself? That's why. He wouldn't. He could. He edited Whispers from Eternity himself, did a beautiful job, but he just didn't want to. And besides, that way we grew too. So anyway, I was working on this and I was so struck by how Yogananda tuned in to Omar Khayyam, not to Edward Fitzgerald who translated it, but to Omar Khayyam's consciousness. I had a very good illustration of it too, a proof of it. I was lecturing in Sydney, Australia, on this book, and somebody raised a hand and he said, well, you know, in this particular stanza, the stanza seems to say one thing and the interpretation something different. And I said, you know, that thought did come to me sometimes, but as I got into it more deeply, I saw that it wasn't. Yogananda really did tune in. But then a woman raised her hand. This was the interesting part. She said, I'm from Iran and my language is Persian. I can read ancient Persian. And so she said, I can say that from the original Persian, his explanation is exact. Edward Fitzgerald missed the point. Yogananda didn't. You see, he tuned in. This is how he wrote the explanations, interpretations of the Bible. He actually prayed to Jesus, am I saying what you want? And he had a vision of Jesus and he saw the Holy Grail come from the lips of Jesus to Yogananda's lips. And Jesus said, the cup from which I drink, thou dost drink. But he tuned in. Those masters are living now. Jesus is just as much alive today as he was 2,000 years ago. Like that beautiful story of Saint Teresa of Avila, who in her old age was crossing a stream she wanted to found a new monastery, and the stream was in flood, and the horse she was on missed its footing and fell into the water. And here she was, an old woman, and all her disciples thought she was drowned. But she suddenly found herself on the opposite bank, completely dry. And Jesus was standing in front of her. And he said, don't feel too badly, Teresa. This is how I treat all my friends. And she said, oh, my Lord, that is why you have so few. But those masters are there always. You're there always. And the one that I was going to speak about, fascinating thing in Yogananda's explanation of Omar Khayyam, was a statement that is very difficult to understand, but Yogananda showed that it meant that many who are manifested into this day of Brahma, this day of creation, many who come into this day at the beginning of the day of Brahma, at the end of the day of Brahma, billions of years later, are still wandering in delusion. That's a bit scary to think we've been wandering in delusion for so long, because every life seems so real. You see this beautiful little innocent babe, innocent? Well, never mind. Who knows what he's done? Yogananda picked up a little baby once that somebody put into his arms, and he nearly dropped it. He said, I could see that this was the soul of a murderer in that little form that seems so innocent. But you're born, as Wordsworth put it, trailing clouds of glory. But it's not only glory, unfortunately. It's everything you've done that makes you so different, that here we are, so many people in this world, two eyes, a nose, a mouth. What can you do with that? And yet the variety is just incredible. Everybody in some way looks different. And if you can't see difference, look closely into the eyes and you'll see there's individuality in everyone. God has expressed himself uniquely in each person. And God has a unique song to sing through each person. And however long it takes you, when you wake up, you'll think it was yesterday. It'll be as if it was nothing. But when you wake up, you'll see that I've always been with you. As St. Augustine said, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. We have come from that, and sooner or later we have to return to that. But it's so easy for the mind to get caught up in things. I mean, there's so much fascination in this world. It takes 5 to 8 million lifetimes, according to the Indian scriptures, to reach the human level. And even from that level, you can fall back if you live badly enough. But on the whole, normally, you'll keep going. But think, once you become a human being, you have the intelligence to become fascinated in so many things, and so people do. Stamp collecting and all the things people can get involved in. I was once playing chess with one of my brother monks, and Yogananda wanted to call the monk, and he said, where is he? And the man said, he's playing chess with Walter. And Yogananda said, oh, what a waste of time. Well, you know, you have to waste time sometime, but the fact is we're on a treadmill and we keep moving. We think we're working hard and you're not going anywhere. What are you doing? The pendulum's going left and then it's going right. And you watch a football game and you think, oh, hooray, the Orioles won, hooray, and tomorrow the Orioles lose, oh, too bad. And it goes on and on and on. Hope you didn't dislike what I said. I mean, we didn't break the picture. That's good. And so, you know, one time I was in Malibu outside Los Angeles giving a lecture, and I was talking about Sai Baba. I wasn't talking about Sai Baba. I was saying that you don't have to go looking for your guru. Wherever you are, if you're sincere, your guru will appear. And because he will come to you, God will send him to you. Anyway, I was saying this, and somebody was sitting under a picture of Sai Baba, and this man was a disciple of Sai Baba, wanted to become a disciple, hadn't yet met him. And just as I said, you don't have to go to India to find him, he'll come to you right here. That picture fell off the wall and landed face up in his lap. When you can live more understanding that everything you want is already here, everything you hope for is already yours. It's important. Jesus said, pray believing, but it's a fact. If you really do believe, it's already yours. It's just a question, because you're still in delusion and think things take time, you've got to work for it. But whatever is yours is already yours. That doesn't mean you can sit back and wait for it to come. It doesn't happen that way. But if you put out the energy, it will come. It cannot but come. And this is true also in inspiration. People think when they're looking for inspiration or trying to find success, they've got to go here or go here. And it's not a pendulum swinging. It's not as if, for example, that if the pendulum toward unhappiness, and mind you, the law of duality is that for everything there's an opposite. For every joy there's a sorrow. It's just the rule of life. For every up there's a down. It's the way this universe was able to be manifested. But if you think that way, and you think that, oh, when the pendulum moves this way, I'm suffering. I don't want suffering, so I'll go more toward joy, more towards pleasure, more towards... You push the pendulum further and further. What's it going to do? Just swing that much further the opposite way. It's inevitable. Now, if you can understand that what you really are looking for is in the center, and this is the truth. For example, when I write music, I don't try for it. I get a very clear picture of what I want, and then I say, well, God, give me something that says that, And I open myself to it, and within a second, it's there. We'll be singing you a song later called Cloisters. And it was like that. It was a series of pieces of music that I wrote on the basis of the Amalfi Coast in Italy. And there was a monastery there, which was now a tourist attraction. So I wanted to write something that was like a monastery, but nonetheless, it isn't still a monastery. So I'd have to introduce another kind of mode of music than just normal monastic kind. And so anyway, with that thought, I wanted it to be inspiring, but not so inspiring that tourists would necessarily get out of their normal mode, which is sort of curiosity more than devotion. So with these thoughts, I said, well, God, give me that melody. It's really interesting how it came, because the first notes, and I didn't think this through until later, but later I looked back and I saw, yeah, that's how it worked. The first notes were Gregorian style. Long I've called you, my Lord, long I've called you. Many years I have longed for your sight. Then it came out of the monastic mode, and it, just a little bit. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. What is it? Yeah. Bathe the darkness with tears of devotion. Now that tears is out of the Gregorian mode. See, the Gregorian chant wouldn't go la 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 la. That takes it out. La 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 la. Then I have to repeat that. Offered candles in prayer to your light. Now, what is the modern mode? It would almost inevitably go, how much longer, friend? Sheer emotion, it wouldn't have worked at all. So I had to rein it in. I could feel that was not divine inspiration. I could feel that there was some habit there of custom of other kinds of music and so on that wanted to pull it up there, but then this divine inspiration reined it in. And so instead of how much longer, friend, it was how much longer, friend, must I cry your name? See, it held it in, and there's much more power. When you get emotion into it, it goes to pieces. You don't have power with shouting and anger. Power comes with control. How much longer, friend, must I cry your name? I am yours, ever yours. Now, how would conventional music end? Always with the tonic. So the normal ending had to be, will you come? Would have killed it. It had to be a melody that took you off into the infinite, into God. And so the melody gave itself to me. I didn't work for it, but I am yours, ever yours, will you come? And you see, it just goes on. This is how anything that you do, if you say, well, God, this is what I need to do, because he's not, if you pray for a good recipe for bread, he's not going to give you a mathematical formula. If you pray for a mathematical formula, he's not going to give you a poem. He'll answer your prayer according to what you ask for. But in any way that you ask, you need to also be clear as to what you want. Most music is vague because it doesn't really have anything to say. Modern classical music virtually has no melody. Why? Because melody expresses your aspiration. Melody expresses your beliefs, your faith. There's no faith, there's no aspiration. People don't believe in anything real anymore, at least at this time in history. As a result, there are no melodies. But if you can really ask clearly what you want, that's again why so much popular music does have beautiful melodies. Because at least things like human love are things everybody understands. Whereas if they're trying to talk about some abstraction, they don't get a melody because they don't know what they're thinking about. But if you have a beautiful melody like Night and Day, Night and day, you are the one. It's beautiful. It's a human emotion, but even that can be turned to God. The feeling of music is something that if you really know what you want to say, then there's so much to be said. I believe, even though melody is going farther and farther away from music, that melody has to be the future of music. That basically music is melody, and everything else is supportive. You know, in many cultures, they don't have anything but melody and rhythm. They don't have harmonies. I know that according to historians, we in the West created harmony. I find that impossible to believe, personally. I think harmony is too much a part of our nature for it to be something only we discovered. And in fact, if you listen to the tribes of Africa singing, they have a wonderful sense of harmony as they're walking through the forest and whatever. It's something that has to be a part of it. But melody is the most important part of all. And if you listen to Indian music, for example, it's all melody. Amashadna mitilo, ashana purilo, shokuli furae jaema. My hopes haven't been fulfilled. Everything in life seems worthless to me. Everything is going away because, Mother, I don't have you. A prayer to God. Beautiful. And the melody says it. But melody says what's in the heart. And if you know what's in your heart, and if you know what you want, that melody will come to you. And it's the same thing with everything. Cooking. I know Yogananda was a great cook. In fact, I remember some jealous Swami from India who he was always jealous of Yogananda. And he said, oh yes, I know Yogananda. He's a very good cook. Well, in fact, he was a good cook. But you know, he said he cooked with his mind up here. And even for cooking, he would ask God and he would feel the taste here. And he would know just what to put in. How much seasoning, how much water, how much everything. Well, in anything that you do, whether it be business, don't think that money is materialistic. Money used for a good purpose, earned for a good purpose, money shared with others, money given to God, this is a good thing. Money earned honorably just to keep your family in comfort is right. To think of money and only money becomes greed. Greed, however, can be in anything that you're doing. If you want too much, that's greed. Moderation in everything, fine. And so if you have a clear picture of what you want, whether it be food, mathematics, poetry, so much poetry is just, I think the whole purpose is that people have nothing to say and don't want anybody else to know it. And so they try to be so vague that nobody knows what they're saying. They don't know either. But everybody will say, oh, that's deep. The truth is that clarity, if you read the sayings of Jesus, if you read the Bhagavad Gita, yes, there's a lot there you can't understand, but it's put so simply, so clearly, that you can understand what you've experienced. You just know that once you've experienced more, you'll understand more. Because clarity is essential. That's why we call our publishing house Crystal Clarity Publishers. We want clarity in everything. Don't think that by vagueness you can express God. It's something that's very real, very dynamic. I remember down in Big Sur in California once, I met an innkeeper. He was a big bear of a man like this, and we got onto the subject of God. And I was saying that I think I've met many more, but at the time I could count mentally quickly about six people I said I think I've met who I thought knew God. He put out a hairy paw, he said, "Shake, you just met the seventh." Well, even the way he said it made me think, oh, no, I don't think so. Truth is clear, truth is simple, truth is something you can tune into right away. And I work hard at making what I write clear. because I think I owe it to the poor reader. He's got a hard enough time reading this stuff anyway. Make it as clear and simple as possible. But all this comes from understanding that that reality is right here and right now. You don't have to strain to reach up for it. It's with you. God is always with you. There was this beautiful story of Saint Anthony of the Desert, who for 16 years was praying in a tomb to Jesus. And finally, he appeared to him, and suddenly all these demons and things that were threatening him vanished. And Saint Anthony said, "Lord, where were you all these years?" And Jesus said, "Anthony, I was always with you." And wasn't that the promise of Jesus in the Bible? "I am with you always." He's with us right now. You know one thing, one reason people don't like to think this way? They hope he didn't notice. Well, believe me, he does. He's already in your mind before you commit the crime. He's already in your mind before you have that wrong thought or do that wrong deed. He does it through you, that's the truth. The trouble is that that little part of him that is you hasn't yet caught on as to how these things work, and so you do the wrong thing. But if you can understand that, in fact, give to him, "God, it was you who did this," he doesn't mind that, he likes it. But he likes it because when you give it to him, then you give him a chance to come in and help you to think better next time, help you to do better. It's not as if he was gloating over the fact that you punched that guy in the nose. Like a cousin of mine who was a bit of a bully, and my mother said to him, "Why, Eddie, you know, when another boy hits you, you should never hit him back." And he very self-righteously said, "Oh, but Mother, I never hit back. I always hit first." Well, Eddie just didn't understand. But the fact is that God puts all of these delusions, it's not that he puts them into our mind, it's that everything being consciousness, everything being spun out of his consciousness, there's so many different levels of that consciousness that we can draw on. And you can draw on the darkness, you can draw on the light. And when you think that, well, I couldn't possibly be like a saint. I mean, give up my beer, or give up getting angry every now and then, or give up whoever I am because you think that's who you are, but you're not. You're only acting that way. You know, all those saints, well, they were like you that at one time, and a heck of a lot worse than you. As Yogananda said, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. Every saint has been through it all. If they can understand you, it's because they've done it. But they've reached the point where they've understood that that didn't give you what at one time they thought it might give. The sense of revenge, how good it feels. And then you get home and you think, "God, I don't know why I feel so unclean." It's because revenge doesn't feel that good. You just think it does. It's because hurting somebody doesn't feel that good because you've really hurt yourself. And it takes a few lifetimes, and a lot of lifetimes, to reach that point where you understand that certain things hurt you more than anyone else. And for your own sake, you give it up. And it becomes like stale cheese. And the saints look back and they don't look at you and think, "Oh, what an evil man you are." They think, "Yeah, I was that stupid once myself." And they want to help you. And so bit by bit, they inspire you to become that. And the funny thing is that all the things that you think of as identical with yourself are not you. And when you find union with God, this is what they all say. All those things, just they don't mean anything to you. You don't have to renounce. They just, so what's it all about? I mean, you have no desire to bark like a dog. When you see a bone on the ground, you don't think of gnawing at it. One time you did. You've lost those tastes. Someday you'll wake up and you won't recognize yourself anymore. you'll be a saint. Jesus did not come on earth to show us how great he was. He came to show us how great we can be. He said it himself. All the masters, they don't come to show us, to make us impressed with anything except our own potential. And so I remember one time there was a man in a group of people, and he was pretty drunk. And he was sort of acting very familiar and putting his arm around Master and talking in a very sort of ebullient way, but not with the kind of respect we would feel. And this Bengali disciple of Master's said to him in Bengali something slighting about this drunk. And Yogananda just looked at him, just a little for a moment sternly, said, "Don't." He respected this person. It was a child of God. And whoever you are and however you are, in fact, I'll never forget an amusing story of one time there was this fundamentalist who was trying to convert him to his church. And Yogananda was trying to say that all is God and there are many ways to God and so on. And finally, Master said, well, because this guy was interpreting everything literally, so Master said, well, think of the story of the Garden of Eden. Satan talking to Eve, the serpent talking to Eve. How can that be? That's surely an allegory. The man said, in those days, serpents could speak. And I've always loved Master's answer. He took his hat off. He said, I bow to the temple of ignorance I behold before me. But even in that, he could be humorous, but he still, the bowing was sincere. Somebody wrote him a letter full of false accusations and so on. When Master saw him, I was there, and when Master saw him, he said, really, you should take up writing. That was the best letter Satan ever wrote me. But in the end, the masters know that all of us are gods in asleep, that's all. We have to wake up. But to wake up, don't think that it's way off there in the future. Don't think, well, look at me. I mean, God, saint, what a joke. No, it's not a joke. You know, I was very deeply impressed with this one. They saw me back, you know, he told me to grow a beard when I was only 23. And in those days, no men wore beards. And so it looked kind of odd. But people seeing me decided I looked like Jesus Christ, because he had a beard, I had a beard. Okay. So they asked me to play the part of Christ in this tableau that they were doing. And it was Christ at Gethsemane, and all I had to do was sort of sigh, so it was simple. No acting task. Anyway, afterwards he said that many of them said you looked like Christ up there. And I said, well, sir, I'd rather be like him than look like him. Well, here's what impressed me. He said, that will come. Completely matter-of-factly. He saw all of us as potential Christs. He didn't see us in terms of our illusions and delusions, our faults and weaknesses. He saw us all in terms of our potential. Someday it will come. Someday you will be like that. Why think then? Why think someday? Why not think right now? As Yogananda used to say, the thing I love about America is the saying, eventually, eventually, why not now? Why not now? Why think? I mean, just think how many lives you've been going. And remember what duality means. The pendulum swings this way, then it swings this way. And then it swings this way, and then it swings this way, and it goes on and on and on. And yet, finally, it all ends in nothing, because duality has to be cancelled out. Every plus is cancelled by a minus. So the sum total is zero. And so every lifetime, somebody begins his life thinking, oh, I'm going to be an engineer, or I'm going to have a lovely home and nice children, or I'm going to be this or that, and all their efforts are put forth. And usually at the end, there's a certain amount of disillusionment and bitterness. Fortunately, not always, but still, You never get what you want. You can't. It's like a carrot on a stick. In fact, the sum total of all your satisfactions and failures, victory, defeat, everything, the sum total mathematically cannot be anything but zero. Now, what do you think? Billions of lives, all for nothing? And that's literally what it is. Nothing. Why not give God a little time? Actually, Sukadeva, a great saint in India, said, "All time is wasted that is not spent seeking God." I don't mean you have to sit in meditation all the time. You'd go to sleep. Might as well face it, you're not ready to sit there in samadhi. Do a little bit. Do what you can. Do what you can do with your mind active and awake and alert. And the rest of the time, whatever you do, just keep thinking of God every now and then. Frank Laubach was a great Christian missionary, and I had a chance to meet him shortly before he died. He said, "I'm suffering from an incurable disease," and I expressed sympathy, and he said, "Yes, old age." But he was alone in Mindanao, I think that's how you pronounce it, in the Philippines. And his wife and family were away, and he was all alone, and with a lot of people who weren't of his faith, and he was, in a sense, lonely, but he thought, why waste time being lonely? I'm going to do something I should have done years ago as a missionary and a minister. I'm going to try to make God a constant companion. And so all that time that he was there, he thought of God not as he. Think how many hymns just speak of he. Why not you? And why so pompously? Why not talk to him intimately? That's why they say thou. Now thou in English sounds formal, but it was meant to be that which the way you'd address your own wife and husband and children, your very own. Think of him as you. And try to share every thought with him. This is what Frank Laubach did. And in sharing every thought, when he was eating breakfast, he would say, "Well, God, I'm having breakfast with you." When he was walking, "God, I'm sharing this walk with you. I feel your energy. I hear your voice in the birds. I feel your strength in the wind, and your cleansing purity in the rain." And every thought he had, he made an effort of will to think to God, so that he found that it was difficult to affirm in the morning and then wake up sort of at the end of the day and realize you haven't done it at all. So he said, "Okay, 1 hour." I know when I was in charge of the monks at SRF, Master wanted us to keep silence and at the table, but they couldn't do it. So I said, "Okay, let's try it one meal at a time. Let's do it at dinner, because we'll have just come from meditation." And it was a little hard at first, but after a while it was not so hard, and finally they kept silence. Then I said, "Well, now why don't we keep silence at breakfast, because we've just come from meditation?" So it wasn't so hard then. We never had to decide to do it at lunch. Nobody wanted to speak anymore. It was so nice to be silent. So if you try something, put your mind to it. Don't think vaguely, "Yes, I've got to," like New Year's resolutions that you have to make the same resolution every year because you didn't keep one for one day in the past year. So you, for 1 hour, say, "I'm just going to think of God." And it would be good to have it an hour that is not too involving. Maybe you take a walk, whatever. But while you're washing the dishes, instead of just turning on the radio and hearing a lot of noise, just think of God. 1 hour, it's not that much. But you'll find that it's awfully nice. In fact, it's wonderful. And the more you feel, the more you talk of him, the more he talks to you. And the more he talks to you, the more his joy fills you. And so you begin to find that that hour went by very nicely. And it takes a little willpower, yes. But then another hour and another hour, and pretty soon it becomes a habit. This is how Frank Laubach felt, that wherever he went, he just felt that God was just behind each tree, each bush, everything, behind his own thoughts. He was a wonderful man. But this is something that all people can do And I proposed an experiment yesterday. This is an experiment too. Just try it. Think of God as right here, right now. Not, oh, someday I'll die and I'll meet him. No, God is here today. And when you can feel him with you, you will be amazed at how many answers come to you. You know, when I write a book, I don't make a plan for the book. I don't even know usually what I'm going to say on the next page. But I ask him, and I'm just amazed to see how much comes out. That at least it inspires me. I don't know about anybody else, but I love the stuff. Because it's filled with a joy that I feel while writing it. And also I feel that I'm writing for a friend. I always visualize my reader as sitting just across the desk from me, neither male nor female, just a person, and I'm talking to him. And so what I write is, in that sense, like a conversation. If you can feel that everything is now, you will have him today. And if you feel it's then, you won't have him until it is now. Because ultimately, to find the infinite and the eternal, you have to realize that that infinite begins in a grain of sand and in an hourglass, as William Blake put it. You have him. You only have to deepen your knowing.